we've got to figure out, and this is not easy. You and I were talking before we hit record on the podcast here. Like, I don't think any of us have figured this out by any stretch, particularly with the nature of technology in today's world. We're working all the time, and we can. We have now the tools and technology to literally work from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to sleep and keep going, and we never get it all done. And there's this expectation that we're going to be doing that. We have to learn personally how to create some boundary and some space. I can be on my phone all day, every day, and not with my wife.
That was Mike Robbins, and he's an expert in teamwork and leadership, and also the author of 4 books, the most recent of which being Bring Your Whole Self to Work. In this episode, Mike and I talk about how people can be authentic on social media, how companies can create environments that help people to do their best work while they get increasingly digitized, and also how our work lives have changed whilst also taking on a lot of these digital tools. But before we kick off, I want to welcome you to Digital Mindfulness. Over the years, we've brought you the best teachers and thought leaders to help you understand what time well spent digital experiences would look like in your own lives. If you're new to our show, then the best place to find out much more about us is to visit digitalmindfulness.net/start, which has a collection of some required listening shows where we discuss everything from becoming more focused to habit building to digital wellness and much, much more. So now on with the show with Mike Robbins. Mike, welcome to Digital Mindfulness, and thanks so much for joining me here on the show today. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, Lawrence, thanks for having me. I appreciate you having me on, and I'm excited about the work you're doing and glad to be here.
So Mike, share with the audience a little bit about yourself and particularly your journey to start to think more about how people can bring their whole selves to work.
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing and speaking and coaching people for the last 18 years, but that wasn't my original career path. I grew up in California in the US, where I still live, and was a baseball player as a kid. I know over where you are in the UK, there's not a ton of baseball, but it's a big thing here in America, as I'm sure you're aware. And I was pretty good at it. I actually got drafted out of high school by the New York Yankees. I didn't end up signing a contract with the Yankees at that time because I got an opportunity. Yeah, I got an opportunity to play baseball in college at Stanford University. And I went to Stanford and then got drafted out of Stanford by another pro baseball team here in the U.S. called the Kansas City Royals. And I signed a contract. And the way that it works in baseball is you get drafted by what's called a major league team, like the Yankees or the Royals, or there's, you know, 28 other major league teams. You have to go into what's called the minor leagues. And every major league team has 6 minor league teams below them. They're different levels. You got to work your way up to get to the major leagues. And unfortunately for me, I was a pitcher in baseball, and I hurt my arm. I tore ligaments in my elbow. I was still in the minor leagues, but I got hurt when I was 23, and then 3 surgeries later at 25, finally had to retire from baseball. But I basically started when I was 7. So it was a big, you know, life trauma, a big life change that I didn't expect or want. And, you know, it took me a while to sort of figure myself out, if you will. But, you know, in my mid-20s, I got a job working in the tech world, you know, here in California. It was during the dot-com boom time. And I went to work for an internet startup company. And, you know, it was different. I was making a big transition in my life, but I noticed some aspects of working in a team and with people that, while it was very different than being in the sports world, there were some things that were similar, and I became really fascinated by the whole team dynamic and how do we interact and how do we communicate and how do we collaborate or not, and what's the general kind of mood or chemistry, as we would call it in sports, of the team. In business, we call it culture. So I became fascinated by that. I was also fascinated by the idea that it wasn't always the most talented people that were the most successful, and it wasn't always the most successful people that were the most fulfilled. And I realized that all my years through school and even through sports and other things, I'd never really learned how to be happy and how to be fulfilled. Like, that wasn't a class I'd ever taken. So I realized, oh, I probably need to do some work on that myself. So after just a couple years working for a few tech companies, I started my own consulting business and really wanted to dig more deeply into some of these issues and topics for myself personally, and hopefully be able to teach and inspire people in the process. And wasn't really sure if I'd get it off the ground, but, you know, 18 years and 4 books later, here I am.
Absolutely. And 18 years is a fantastic time to be in business. But Mike, I'm wondering if there are any similarities to the sports teams that you were working with and researching, and also those in the business context, because the motivations for the two seem quite different.
Yes. Well, yes, it is. It is. Yes and no. I mean, what I found, in sports, what you have is there's a very singular focus on, you know, whether it's a football team, whether it's a baseball team, whether it's a basketball, whatever it is, the focus is on, you know, winning the championship. However, what I learned as an athlete, what a lot of people don't realize on the outside of sports, is there's a ton of internal competition. There's a ton of internal and individual ambition that makes it actually challenging to get a team of people. Even, you know, again, a football team playing in the World Cup or a baseball team playing in the World Series, or you would think, oh, all they want to do is just win that championship. Well, yeah, but not really, actually. And so it takes something pretty extraordinary to get a sports team all on the same page, because you have a lot of really talented people with big egos. And again, in the business world, the goal is different. There's not a championship to win per se. However, in a lot of organizations and on a lot of teams, there's individual ambition. There are some team goals that people are trying to accomplish. And so it's that same dynamic of how do you get people's personal ambition, their own egos, their own desires, their own whatever they want, aligned with the group. And when you can do that, something really extraordinary can happen. And that's not easy to do. And anybody listening who's ever worked in it with a group of people knows that's actually really hard. And quite frankly, most teams struggle to make that happen, which is, I find it fascinating. And it's been something that I've been passionate about for much of my life.
Well, I really want to go on from this, Mike, because you did mention previously that you've now published 4 different books. And the latest book that you've just published now, Bring Your Whole Self to Work, has just been released. And I wonder if you can just tell us a little bit more about that and why that's important.
Well, there's a few reasons. I mean, I think the way that we work today, and you know this given your work, is so different than the way we worked 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago with respect to technology, but also in terms of, I mean, again, just think about, you know, you're sitting in London and I'm sitting here in San Francisco and we're having this conversation on the computer and we're recording it and people can listen to it anywhere in the world. Like, I kind of take that for granted now, but it's like, yeah. If my dad came back from the dead and he died 18 years ago and I said, hey dad, guess what? Because my dad was actually in radio. I can sit in my office and put a headset on. It would like blow his mind. He wouldn't even know what I was talking about, right? I mean, so again, technology is extraordinary. And at the same time, what it's done is it's put an enormous amount of pressure on us to, there's so much input and information coming at us, and there's so much expectation for how quickly we communicate and how connected we are, you know, nationally, globally, with people anywhere at any time. And what I think that's provided, that the downside of it, and I know you talk a lot about this and look at this and study this, is that it can create a lot of stress for us. It can create issues with respect to our well-being and how we connect as human beings. The upside is the business world has become a lot less structured and formal. We don't all, and most of us don't, wake up in the morning and put a suit on and walk into the office at 9 o'clock in the morning and stay there until 5 or 6 and then go home to our families. I mean, there are still people that work that way, but the vast majority of us work in very sort of creative, dynamic, fluid environments. And because of that, and because of the way I think we've evolved and the amount of diversity that exists in the world, what's incumbent upon us if we're going to be successful and effective and fulfilled in our work is we got to be willing to bring as much of ourselves as possible to the work that we do. And if companies are going to succeed and thrive in today's environment, they got to create environments that are conducive to that. Because if people feel like they have to show up and literally leave their heart and soul at the door before they walk into the office or do their work, they're not going to stay that long. They're not going to engage and they're not going to succeed.
That's a really great summary, and I really love in particular just how important it is for workspaces to be places where employees can do their best work. But I wonder if you can expand a little bit more on what it means to bring your whole self to work. What does that mean exactly?
Well, you know, the first of the five principles that I talk about in Bring Your Whole Self to Work is around being authentic. And this is something that I've studied. I wrote a book about authenticity that came out 9 years ago. I've been studying authenticity for the last decade. And the way I define authenticity is honesty without self-righteousness and with vulnerability. And so what I mean by that is that being authentic isn't simply just about, I'm going to speak my mind and tell everyone what I think. That's fine if that's what we want to do, but often there's a lot of self-righteousness in our opinions. This is how it is, and this is right, and this is wrong, and it can create a lot of separation and conflict. So can we remove that self-righteousness? Do we have the awareness, the courage to speak up, to speak our mind, but not do it in a way that's banging our fist on the table and telling people how it is? And then can we actually be willing to embrace vulnerability? And vulnerability, I love the definition that Dr. Brené Brown at the University of Houston uses for vulnerability. She says that vulnerability is emotional exposure, risk, and uncertainty. So if you think about emotional exposure, risk, and uncertainty, there are very few things, if anything, in life that's really meaningful and important to us that we ever experience or accomplish personally or professionally that does not involve emotional exposure, risk, or uncertainty. So being authentic means that we have a willingness to let people know who we really are, to share some of our story, to share some of our insight, our wisdom, our passion, our fear, our humanity, if you will. And as simple of an idea as that is, it can actually be a really bold and almost radical act for us. Again, the paradigm of work for many of us for a long time was, again, we have to be professional. And there's still lots of environments where we feel the pressure to, I have to act and talk and be a certain way. However, what really creates the conditions for us to perform at the highest level, particularly in teams, is what's known as psychological safety. And psychological safety is a term that was coined by a woman named Amy Edmondson at Harvard Business School. And it's essentially trust at a group level. It means I'm a part of a group where I feel safe to be myself, to speak up, to make a mistake, to disagree, to take a risk and fail. And if I'm part of a group where those things are safe, I'm more likely to thrive and succeed. If I'm in a part of a group where it doesn't feel safe to do those things, it takes an enormous amount of stress and pressure and energy for me to just show up and be able to do my job.
I think that's really important. And for me, it's most interesting that we're actually focusing our talk on the crucible of work, because there are so many challenges that modern workers face today, in particular the need to be high performers with all of this technology they have around them. But what's interesting is that the work life and home life, they tend to blend together all the time. And so something like this is really important.
Completely. Well, you know, I was at a conference just yesterday in Las Vegas speaking with one of my clients, technology company, and the leader of this sales organization who was up in front of the group, he was super passionate and he's trying to get his team fired up. And then he said at one point, he said, look, what drives me is my family. Like, that's my motivator. That's what matters most in my life is my wife and his kids are grown now. And he told a story about driving his daughter to college, to university, to drop her off. And he said on the way to dropping her off, at some point in the conversation, she had been a tennis player in high school and as a kid growing up. And she asked her dad, hey, dad, how come you didn't come to that many of my tennis matches? And he said, you know, she could have punched me in the face and it would have felt better than hearing that from her. And basically, he said, you know, what I realized and one of the regrets that I have is that I worked so much when my kids were growing up that I missed things. And he said to everybody, and he said, look, I know this is a challenge. And here we are sitting in Las Vegas on a Sunday. They were having their sales conference over a weekend. And he's like, and you're here. It's a Sunday. You're away from your families. There's sacrifices we have to make. He said, but I really want to create an environment where, yes, we work hard and we produce the results we want to produce, but I want you to be able to spend time with your families or do the things that are important to you. And that's a long way of saying, Lawrence, in response to your question, and back to talking about the world as it is today and how we work, we've got to figure out, and this is not easy. You and I were talking before we hit record on the podcast here. Like, I don't think any of us have figured this out by any stretch, particularly with the nature of technology in today's world. We're working all the time, and we can. We have now the tools and technology to literally work from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to sleep and keep going, and we never get it all done. And there's this expectation that we're going to be doing that. We have to learn personally how to create some boundary and some space. I can be on my phone all day, every day, and not with my wife and not with my girls. You know, and so how I show up at work, in my work, is similar to how I show up in my life. And so bring your whole self to work is really about bringing our whole selves to life. I'm, again, just focusing on the dynamic of how we work, because that's where a lot of us spend a lot of our time.
You know, everything that we're focusing on here with the workplace, and particularly how we construct our workplaces, it makes me think about the conference that we had here, I think it was a couple of years ago, particularly on technology and work-life balance. And one of the things to come from the conference was that because we can literally take the office with us everywhere we go, that we never ever leave the office, basically. So people are really compelled to keep working all of the time. And this is particularly so with all of the engaging or addictive qualities that people have in their phones or within their different work applications. So one of the things it would be great to get your opinion on was that this type of work, this type of constant and almost compulsive working that a lot of people do have to engage in now, that this only benefits a certain type of person, a person with a certain personality type. Is that something that has come up in your research?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we're all trying to figure it out. And I think you're right. I mean, I think we have multiple, you know, not to say that we all are schizophrenic, but we do have multiple personalities within us, or multiple personas, if you will. And I think one of the challenges, to your point, you know, whether we have multiple devices or the same device, again, is figuring out how do we integrate our life in a way that's conducive to our well-being, to our relationships, to the things that matter most. You know, I was at a working with an executive leadership team for one of my clients, and spent a few days with them at an offsite. And during the offsite, a former CEO of a tech company in Silicon Valley came in. He's an advisor, he's on their board, and he came to give a talk. And he was talking about going on vacation or going on holiday. And he said, look, I know most of you don't actually go on holiday. You just work from different places. And everybody laughed, including me. And it was this moment of like, wow, yeah, people are, you know, again, at this level, this senior executive level in this company, and this company's in growth mode, and, you know, going away to spend time with family, to take time off. And this is something here in the US in particular, we have a real problem with. That people don't take breaks, people don't take vacations, as we call them here. They're just constantly working. And again, I think it's something that each of us have to work out for ourselves. I was away earlier this summer with my own family and had made a commitment to my own team, like, I'm really going to unplug, I'm going to disconnect. And I found it really challenging, especially the first few days. And even when I finally was able to disconnect from work, I still found myself, you know, checking my social apps and checking this, you know, and it was like, hey, I'm not going to post anything, but it was more just because I had said, I'd even put something on social media, I'm going to be off for a week, everybody, have a nice week, see you later. It was more out of my own shame, like, I don't want to, you know, violate the commitment that I made, but it still was like, wow, I saw really up close my own addictions to just constantly checking and checking the news or checking the sports scores or whatever it is. And it's like, wow. You know, amazingly, and we all know this, these tech companies have designed these devices and these apps to do that to us, right? To the dopamine hit in our brain to get us physiologically addicted to them. And so I think, again, we have to figure out how to manage that for ourselves. And then even inside of our organizations, I can't tell you how many times I'm with a group of people, I'm at an offsite, a retreat, we're there to really connect, the team's there to connect, to think, to come up with ideas, to brainstorm about how we can work better and the goals that we have. And literally people are sitting in the room and they're not even listening to each other. They're on their phone or they're on their laptop. And this is an offsite. I mean, this isn't like a weekly team meeting where everyone's in the midst. This is like we went away somewhere so that we could actually have some white space. And it's, and I don't, it's not even a judgment of them as much as it's just a reflection of the world in which we're living right now. And we have to figure this out some way so that it's more conducive to us being creative and productive.
So, Mike, one of the next topics that you speak about in the book is emotional intelligence. And I'm wondering why that particular topic was so high up in terms of the order of the book.
Yeah, well, you know, emotional intelligence is something, you know, I go back to my time as an athlete, right? And there was always these, there was something about I would watch both coaches that I had and teammates, but there was some intangible quality that certain people had that I was fascinated by. Like, how come one person can handle the stress and pressure of a situation more than another person that's not necessarily based on their talent? Or how come one coach somehow or another had a way of motivating and inspiring me and sort of instilling a certain amount of confidence in me when another didn't necessarily? And I was, you know, I found that fascinating. And as I started to research and study different things in my work in the early days, you know, I came across this notion of emotional intelligence, right? And realized, oh, that completely makes sense. And if you think about it in the business world, I say this often to people, like, how many of you have ever had a boss who was really smart but terrible with people? And everybody laughs, right? Because everyone's had that, like, oh, that person got promoted because they're smart and they're talented, but they actually don't have very good people skills. They don't understand how to, you know, manage people who are stressed out or need support or whatever the case is. So emotional intelligence really, right, there's two components. There's self-awareness and self-management. So how do we deal with life? How do we deal with stress? How do we deal with technology? How do we deal with everything coming at us? Do we have some sense of self-awareness and can we manage ourselves? And then there's social awareness and relationship management. How do we deal with people? And regardless of the type of work that we do, even if we're doing something super technical and very much individually focused where you don't have to have a ton of interaction with people, those two things, right, managing and being aware of ourselves and then being aware of other people and managing relationships, they're fundamental to just about everything we do in life and definitely everything we do in work. So if we're going to have a discussion about bringing our whole selves to work, we have to look at how do I develop or expand my emotional quotient, my EQ, my emotional intelligence. Because that's actually, there's a story I share at the beginning of that chapter in the book. I went to go speak at an event at Adobe, one of my clients here in Silicon Valley, and the head of talent at the time, this guy named Jeff, was the one who invited me in. I was speaking to a group of managers, and he introduced me, and he said, Mike's here to talk about emotional intelligence, which we sometimes refer to as EQ. He said, I've always believed that your IQ gets you your job, but your EQ gets you promoted. And everybody kind of laughed, and then I stood up and said, well, Jeff basically just gave my whole presentation in one sentence. Like, that's it. You know, that's what I was there to talk about. Not just about them getting promoted, but if you want to move forward in your career, you know, it's not going to be by just getting smarter and smarter and knowing more stuff. That's helpful. But what you're going to really want to do is develop your capacity for more self-awareness, more self-management, more social awareness, more relationship management. And that, I think, is so essential, especially in today's world.
I think, Mike, listening to that just now, it just makes me think that there's so much pressure on office workers, not only to perform at their jobs, but also internally to, again, be their best selves, that there's so much information out there for people to digest that it's often difficult for people to think, actually, where do I place my self-development or personal development attention?
It is. I mean, the thing is, you know, many years ago, there wasn't hardly enough information that we could find on stuff like this. Now there's so much, it's hard to know what to sift through. And that's where I think it becomes a sense of discerning what things speak to me and how can I grow and develop in a way that serves me. I mean, again, just you and I having this conversation on a podcast, right? Like, podcast didn't exist 20 years ago. And even 10, 15 years ago when people first started podcasting, I don't know if you remember this, that it was like, oh, podcasting became a big thing. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, that's old. Now everyone's watching video. Nobody wants to just listen to audio. But what we found and why podcasting has had this huge renaissance is because what we realize about just listening to a podcast, and people listening to us right now are probably listening on a device, walking, running, exercising, in the car, on the train, at in the office doing something else. So it's a positive aspect of multitasking because it's a more passive way of learning. I often listen to podcasts when I'm exercising. I listen to podcasts when I'm traveling. I listen to podcasts when I'm in the car or, you know, commuting, because I can focus on driving and be safe doing that and still listen to the podcast in the background. If I had a video on, I could not do that. You know, that's, I'm saying as an example, this is one way to learn, if you will. There are lots of other ways. For me personally, I've learned I need to go away at least once a year, if not more, and go take a workshop or do a retreat or something that's going to be more immersive. It forces me to unplug and disconnect from my life and my work and all of that and really immerse myself in whatever it is I'm wanting to learn or how I'm wanting to grow. We have to figure out the best ways that support us in those regards and know a little bit, again, about ourselves and about what is it that I'm wanting to develop, if you will, and then figure out the best path for that to happen.
You know, one of the key things, Mike, that you've been speaking about in relation to the book, particularly, you know, speaking up for yourself and saying the things that are on your mind, because that's going to be useful in the work context. I'm wondering whether everything in the book that you have, you know, bring your whole self to work, whether this is for a more senior person, for someone that's actually got roots and a foundation in an organization, do you think that everything that you're talking about can be applied to someone who's more junior, who's looking to establish themselves in an organization?
I think that's a great question. I think it's both. I think from my experience of my own life and my own career, as well as working with people earlier in their careers, I think one of the challenges we face when we're young in our career is, first of all, a lack of experience, which makes sense, and a certain lack of maturity, which also makes sense. It's not a judgment, but, you know, if you're 23, 24, 25 years old, you have a certain amount of life experience. You have a certain amount of experience being an adult. And again, most of our worldview at that point, or our influence when we're really young and early in our career, comes from school and how we're educated. And the way that we're educated, although education continues to evolve and has become, you know, more innovative and dynamic in recent years, but it's still very much about learning information, being able to regurgitate that information to say, I learned it. And then, as you were talking about, getting degrees and certificates and things to say, you're now, you know, you've got this degree, which is wonderful. But you get into the business world, whether you work for a large corporation, large organization of any kind, a smaller company, or even work for yourself, it's really more about taking what you know and then translating it into results. That's very different than in school, because, again, you sit around a meeting at work, like, people don't really care. I mean, yeah, maybe you'll impress someone with how smart you are, but that doesn't ultimately produce the result. So you have to start to shift your worldview and your perspective to realize, like, oh, I'm not here to impress people. I'm not here to get a good grade or a good performance review. I'm actually here to have impact with the work that I do, to deliver results, to provide value, if you will, to the customer or to the internal partner or to whomever it is. So that being said, another thing that happens when we're younger in our careers is that we try to compensate for our lack of experience and for our lack of skills in some ways. And so learning how to, early on in our careers, show up as authentically as we possibly can to bring our whole selves to work can actually help speed up our development process and take a lot of the stress and pressure that we put on ourselves to think, I'm supposed to know more than I know, because most people don't expect you to know everything when you're, again, early in your career. Fast forward to people who are further in their careers. One of the challenges that happens as you move along, and again, I'm thinking of this in the business world, but again, it could be, again, for people who have businesses of their own, whatever the environment looks like, as we move along, we start to have this assumption that we assume the people around us and the world expects us to know lots of things. And, you know, again, if I've been working for 20 or 30 years and I have some big role or title, or I'm the president of this company or whatever, I probably do know a lot of stuff, but I'm a human being. And of course, there's a ton of stuff that I don't know. And then what happens, we start to compensate as we move further along in our careers, pretending like we don't have certain insecurities or vulnerabilities because we're not supposed to anymore. It's like not socially acceptable when I'm 55 years old to say, well, you know, this still makes me really nervous, or I don't really know how to do this, or I'm not very good at this. We've somehow learned how to compensate for certain deficiencies that we think we have. And then what happens is it's sometimes harder for us to ask for help. It's harder for us to admit that we don't know stuff, or we need, or whatever. And what they found, research has shown that actually as people move up further in leadership positions inside of organizations and corporations, that oftentimes they become less open, less transparent. They start to think like, I have to act like a senior or whatever to whatever. And they don't realize that a lot of what allowed them to be successful to get to that point is what's going to help them continue to be successful. It's almost like this change in persona can happen, if you will. Because the truth of the matter is, if I get to a really senior position, I'm now more afraid. I have more to lose. So it then becomes harder and a bigger risk for me to be open and to be vulnerable in certain ways. So that's a long way of saying, I think this work and what I'm talking about in Bring Your Whole Self to Work is relevant both for people earlier in their careers and people further along, just for different reasons, but it's still valuable and important.
So Mike, one of the other things that you speak about in the book is this whole idea of the growth mindset and how it applies to this whole context. But can you tell me a little bit more about what that is, what the growth mindset is?
Yeah, well, we talked about, you know, the first principle is be authentic. The third principle is emotional intelligence. You know, that second principle that we didn't really touch on is about utilizing the power of appreciation. The principle number four is embrace a growth mindset. And growth mindset is a concept that was developed by a professor at Stanford University named Carol Dweck. And what Professor Dweck essentially has been studying for the last 30 years and what she developed in this notion of growth mindset, it actually started, initially her research started in education, and she was trying to figure out how come certain students succeed in school when other students don't. And conventional wisdom was, well, it's based on their IQ, how smart they are, and it's based on, you know, how they're raised and some of their habits at home, right? If their parents make them study and these things, right? And that's what we all assume. And there are those things actually absolutely do factor into a student's success in school, how intelligent he or she is and what kind of study habits and environment discipline at home, so to speak. But again, if anyone has children, particularly if you have more than one child or you've seen two or three, maybe a sibling, two or three or more kids come out of the same house with similar intelligent levels, raised a similar way, they'll go to school and often perform very differently. And it's like, well, wait a minute, there's got to be something else. And so what she found, this something else, was what she calls growth mindset. And it's basically, how do we relate to and deal with challenges that we're faced with? And so the student that comes from this more growth mindset perspective would be excited to continue to learn and be challenged. Give me a harder problem. I want to figure it out. The student with the more fixed mindset was more interested in getting the right answer. And if he or she couldn't get the right answer and then was deemed to be not very smart or not a very good student, they would simply just quit. But the fixed mindset student, even that was deemed to be smart or intelligent, would want to get the same type of problems over and over again so he or she could get the right answer and still be considered a good, smart student, if you will. The growth mindset student was less interested in the outcome and more interested in the process and learning and knowing that if I keep getting harder and harder problems to solve, I will get better and better and better and grow, and I can work on myself and develop certain skills. Fixed mindset is about like, this is what I got, this is all I got, this is the best I can do. Growth mindset is basically the idea that I can put forth effort and challenge myself, embrace being uncomfortable, and learn and grow in the process. And if you think about this, now her work has expanded out into the business world and all other aspects of society. I really love the component of growth mindset that really looks at how do we deal with challenges and disappointments and things that are frustrating. And one of the stories that I tell in the book is about a friend of mine who talked to me a number of months after my baseball career ended. And he said to me, he was worried about me because he knew that I was going through a really difficult time. And he said, Mike, when you go through something difficult or challenging, there's a tendency to ask a really simple but very dangerous question. He said, the question that we often ask ourselves when something bad happens is, why did this happen to me? Or why is this happening to me? He said, you're probably asking yourself this question right now. You hurt your arm. It doesn't seem fair. I would probably be asking myself that question if I were you. He said, but that question is really dangerous because if you keep asking that question, the only responses you'll get, even if you just ask it in your own mind, is some reason or justification or validation for why it's not fair, for why you got a raw deal or you're a victim. He said, but if you change one word in that question, it'll fundamentally change the way you're relating to this challenge and any challenge you face. He said, change the word to the word for. Why is this happening for me? And I remember when he said that to me. Now, this was my friend Brian, who's a few years older than me. I trusted him. he cared about me, had my back. And I remember thinking, oh, that's too simplistic, or he doesn't understand what I'm going through, or it's not happening for me. This really sucks and it happened to me. But as I left our conversation that day and I started to ask myself that question, what I noticed was, and it wasn't an overnight thing, it was over a series of weeks and months and ultimately even years, quite frankly, the more I asked that question about that challenge in my life, that difficulty, that disappointment, that change in direction that I did not want to happen, that seemed really tragic and awful to me, the more I was able to start to see, wow, this injury, this disappointment, there's so much here. There's so much growth opportunity for me to learn. And again, most of us can look back in our lives and look at disappointments or challenges or even heartbreaks or tragedy. And if there's enough time, we can look back and go, wow, I can see the gift in that. I can see the blessing in that. I can see what I learned. The challenge for us in life is on a daily basis. As we deal with the small and sometimes big challenges that come our way, can we take a growth mindset approach, which is really embracing the things that come our way, even the stuff that we find difficult and challenging and we don't necessarily like, is this is an opportunity for me to learn, for me to grow, for me to develop myself. Fixed mindset, again, is more about, I got to get the right answer. I got to do it perfect. I got to not mess up, which creates an enormous amount of stress and pressure on us. Growth mindset opens it up expansively.
You know, Mike, in your book, you pack these five different principles in there about how people can bring, of course, their whole selves to work. But I'm wondering whether you can speak about their digital equivalents. Because whenever I go to conferences and speak to people, they would say to me, for example, that they do bring their whole selves with them everywhere. And a lot of who people are is invested in their smartphone, or is invested into their social media profiles or their LinkedIn profiles or whatever. So I'm wondering what the digital equivalent, or for our digitized lives, what the equivalent is to, say, the growth mindset, or to have emotional intelligence, or bringing, again, our whole selves to our work.
I mean, I think it's interesting. I get the question a lot over the years, especially in the last decade, like, do I think that the internet and particularly social media expands our capacity or diminishes our capacity to be authentic? And my response to that is, well, I think it's both, right? I think there's opportunities. One of the beautiful things I think about the digital world and all of the different platforms we have to express ourselves right now is that there's an opportunity. Again, I mean, even just you and I talking on this podcast, you know, writing a blog post, putting a post on Instagram or Facebook or anywhere on social media, is that there's an opportunity for us to be authentic and real in ways, in public ways, that we didn't have before. We didn't have an audience, a diverse and global audience, if you will, to express ourselves. Now, the downside of that, of course, is that we can put out all kinds of stuff, sometimes things that are really mean and angry and divisive, if you will. And we can also then, because just like in life, we walk around with personas, we want people to perceive us a certain way. Online and in the digital world, we can polish up that persona even more. We can put a filter on the photo. We can, you know, I always laugh. I mean, we go on vacations with our, you know, trips, holidays with my family. And I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day about sometimes how it can be stressful and my girl's getting in arguments and fights and whatever. And he goes, but the stuff you post on Facebook all looks really great. And I'm like, yeah, man, that's Facebook. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not real life. Like, that's the picture when everyone was happy and we were standing in front of the thing saying, look what we did. But in reality, 2 minutes before the picture, everybody was yelling and screaming and crying. And do you know what I mean? So again, and that's just part of life. But so I would say that we have to challenge ourselves if we're going to show up authentically in our digital life, which we can absolutely, and there's an opportunity to do that. And we all know people who actually, when you look at their posts or you read what they write and share or the things that they do, you're like, wow, there's a realness and an authenticity to it. And then we look at others and it's not even from a judgmental place. It's like, wow, that is really polished and pristine. And maybe that's what they want to put out to the world and that's fine. But I believe that all of these things, whether we're talking about authenticity, whether we're talking about appreciation, you know, one of the questions that I post on social media a couple times a week is, what are you grateful for in this moment? It's a super simple question. And I do it for two reasons. I do it because I'm really committed to inspiring people, myself included, to focus on what we're grateful for. But I do it also selfishly because when I post that question, people respond. And not only does it make me feel good to read what they write about what they're grateful for, it gives me permission to stop and focus on what I'm grateful for too. Right? Emotional intelligence, right? Can I be self-aware and can I manage myself online? Maybe right in the moment when I post something about politics or someone responds and argues with me, can I take a moment to breathe before I respond back to that as opposed to maybe not escalate the situation, right? In terms of growth mindset, right? Can I look at things that happen online? I know one of the areas for growth for me online is like, and this happens to all of us, right? You ever scroll through Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or anything and you see something, or just online, you see something great that someone else has done or accomplished or experienced, and instead of being happy for them, you start feeling bad about yourself. Oh God. Wow. Look at them. Oh geez. They're really cool. I'm a loser. You know, that voice in our head. So like, I try to do it in a way, can I actually open up and expand my capacity for celebrating other people's successes, being grateful and joyful for them and not having it be about me, you know? And sometimes I'm better at times than others in that. And I have to be mindful of when and how do I go onto social media to look at what other people are doing? Because again, I want to know what's happening in the lives of my friends and support and celebrate them. But I know sometimes if I'm in an insecure moment, that's probably not the best thing for me to do. And then the fifth principle, which we haven't touched on yet directly, is about creating a championship team or really building a team. And again, I think digitally, there are so many tools and platforms we have now, and companies understand this and utilize this. If we can use technology in a positive and powerful way, we can absolutely create community online where we feel connected to each other. But we all know sometimes, even with these great social platforms and all of this technology, it can disconnect us more than anything. Again, we're emailing someone who sits three seats from us. We're doing things that aren't creating connection and collaboration, actually create separation. So again, it's a long way to answer your question. Yes, I do believe these things all relate to us digitally and online. And I think we have to be mindful because the pitfalls digitally are as significant, if not even more significant. And I would also say, though, that at the end of the day, if we're really going to bring our whole selves to work and build the kind of relationships and community that we want, it can't just happen digitally and online. It has to happen human to human. And maybe, again, it could be even back before we had all these platforms, people still worked in different places around the countries, around the world. What did we do? We picked up the telephone and we had a conversation with somebody. That was the technology that we had. And it wasn't quite the same as sitting in the same room with someone and talking to them face to face, but it was the best alternative. And we did the best we could with that. So sometimes in all of this, I will often say to people, listen, don't send an email, don't send a text, don't be on Slack, don't send them a Facebook message. Pick up the telephone, or if it makes you feel better, use Skype or Zoom or one of the video technologies, but talk to them live in real time, just like if they were sitting in the room, and that will probably help resolve the conflict way better.
So Mike, in this age where we are expected to be contactable 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, what would you say are the most important human qualities and how do we cultivate those?
I think, the one that came to my right when you asked the question is empathy. And I think one of the things that we know, whether we're just talking about email or any electronic communication, is it lacks a certain amount of humanity, a certain amount of connection, right? It's why people online will say nasty things to each other that they would never say if they were in someone's presence, physical presence. If I were sitting right with you face to face, eye to eye, I'm less likely to say something mean and hurtful than if we're online because I don't have to deal with the actual impact of it. And one of the reasons why my work is so, and I'm so passionate, right? The subtitle of my book, Bring Your Whole Self to Work, is How Vulnerability Unlocks Creativity, Connection, and Performance. One of the things we know, and the research shows us this, but we also know this from personal experience, is the natural human response to vulnerability is empathy. When someone's vulnerable and they're real and they share their experience, the natural human response is, wow, you feel like that? I feel like that. It's that look. I mean, we had, and we're still in the midst of this whole Me Too moment in culture where women in particular, people are particularly sharing their stories of dealing with a certain type of abuse, which is really intense with respect to those stories. But as people started to share their stories, all of a sudden people started sharing their stories, saying, me too. And it wasn't simply just that I had that experience. Maybe I had a different experience, but I know what that feels like. And that's true for any human experience. When you share your real experience, now I don't know what it's like to be you. You don't know what it's like to be me. We have different backgrounds and experiences, and we have all different types of aspects of our life and our story and our personality and our journey and how we look and all that that may be different. However, when we get real, when we, as I talk about in the book, lower the waterline on the iceberg and expose and express more of who we really are, what's amazing is usually what's down way below the waterline is very similar. Like there's so much common ground for us as human beings. And so I think in today's hyper-connected, super fast-paced world, what sometimes gets lost and gets missed in all of it, as we're again communicating online so much, is that human connection, that empathy, that like, hey, you know what? We're all in this thing together. We're all doing the best we can. Even if we disagree about politics and religion and life and we're everything. You know what I mean? It's like human to human. And so what we got to figure out, and this is challenging, and I struggle with this in my own life and in my work, and I think most of us do, is how can we have those moments of real human connection with each other, even if the only way that we interact is digitally and the amount of time we have to interact with each other is very short and fleeting. We've got to figure out how to bring more empathy and human connection into the equation if we're going to really build relationships that matter, if we're really going to do work that matters to us. You know, and that I think is one of the biggest challenges that we face right now. But I think it's absolutely possible. I think we've all experienced it. And then we just have to figure out how we can replicate it and make it more consistent.
That's great, Mike. I 100% agree with you. So where can people find out more about you and your work and connect with you?
Oh, well, I appreciate you asking. The best place to do that is at my website, which is just mike-robbins.com. That's mike-robbins.com.
Fabulous. Well, Mike, look, it's been a complete pleasure having you on the show today, and I really appreciate you sharing your time and your wisdom with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.